Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and video show which brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. If you're new to the channel, please subscribe so you won't miss a new episode. I'm your host, Fritz Bussemaker, and today I'm delighted and privileged to have a conversation with Peter Sarkoff. Peter, welcome to the show.
Hi, Fritz. Pleasure to be with you.
Allow me to introduce Peter in a couple of words. Now, you're a Canadian living in Atlanta, Georgia, in the US for over 20 years. You are in branding. We're going to talk about branding quite a lot. You are the founder and CEO of Seer, which is about branding. But you've previously worked for Coca-Cola. You've worked for major brands like the NBA, the MLB, the NHL. And you also worked on the level of the Salt Lake Olympics, where you branded the hockey matches. So, Peter, again, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
And if I read up on your background, I see a long and strong connection with sports. Now, first question is, are you an athlete yourself?
I am, but I would have to put myself in the weekend warrior class.
Okay.
I grew up an athlete, played sports my entire life, and obviously thoroughly enjoyed it. As a Canadian, of course, you pretty much have to play hockey to get a passport. So I was a hockey player and a soccer player, a runner, golfer. A lot of great lessons to be learned in playing sports, I think, as a child when you're growing up.
Okay, so you played a lot of sports growing up, but then you moved into sports marketing. How did that work?
Well, so there was a bit of an interlude before I found my way into the professional ranks of sports on the marketing side of things. I actually really started my career in a therapeutic environment and spent about 5 or 6 years working with drug addicted and alcoholic kids. And that's really sort of, in a strange way, the precursor to the marketing side for me, because in that environment, you know, obviously you spend a lot of time trying to understand what's triggering behavior in people, and frankly, how to reshape negative behavior into something much more positive so that, you know, people can sort of get out from underneath the weight of addiction. So I know that sounds like a really strange interlude. At the same time, I had started my first company, I would say maybe business is a better way to say it, and which was really based around brokering high-end cars. And that was my introduction to sports. I actually had a client who was recommended. He was the president and general manager of a hockey team. The process of the transaction on his vehicle went so well, he literally said to me, "You have to come work for me. What's it going to take?" I really didn't think he was serious. He was very serious. And so we negotiated my entry into professional sports. That's literally how it happened.
Okay. So it was a little bit of a coincidence there. You weren't looking for it, but somebody brought you in.
Yeah. And, you know, I knew sports, obviously, from growing up with it. It's not like I didn't understand anything about marketing. I would say, you know, I came into marketing and that realm more with sort of the sociology / psychology perspective of marketing and understanding behavior. So, you know, through the rest of my career, that, you know, that sort of has been maybe a common red thread through sort of my entire, you know, professional career and development, and how I sort of sought out and learned about leadership, and they all sort of kind of come back to those connectors for me.
Okay, now you just mentioned an important word for this program, leadership. What did you learn about leadership?
Well, look, I can tell you early on when I was in that therapeutic environment, it was probably the first big lesson that I would say was kind of a milestone professionally for me. I had an individual who was on my caseload who was doing really well and then had a you know, pretty significant slip and went back out to using drugs again and in a drug-induced state. Killed his grandmother. Just an absolutely horrific story. I was really very broken up about it, went to see my clinical director, you know, expecting a very empathetic sort of, you know, response in terms of walking a young professional through kind of the first time something horrible like this happens. And I really got the exact opposite. He sort of, you know, lit me on fire and took that moment because I really trusted him. He's still actually a mentor of mine today. And the lesson in that moment was, this is way bigger than you, Peter. And the work you're doing is not for you. And it's not for that particular individual. You are really a vessel of this message. And if he gets it, he gets it. And if he doesn't, you need to get out of the way of all of that. So it was a bit of a ego deflation, professional ego deflation. And honestly, a bit of a right sizing, Fritz, in terms of, you know, what was my role there? Why was I doing that work? And then really about there's a whole group of kids that you need to get back in there and do your job with. So I can't afford to have you sidelined because you are interpreting that somehow you didn't do something right. And that's why this thing happened. So from a leadership perspective, like I said, it was not expected. But it was a huge lesson for me in terms of, you know, that notion of being a wartime leader versus a peacetime leader, if that makes sense.
And I understand that. And what also resonates with me is look at the bigger picture.
Yeah, it was look at the bigger picture and get yourself out of the way. You're really kind of very professionally self-absorbed right now. And of course, I was totally blind to that at that time. And especially as a young person who, you know, was genuinely really sort of disappointed and hurt by what had happened and, you know, thought I was being very self-reflective. But in fact, you know, if I was taking an honest look at it, was making it more about myself as a professional than what the actual work was that needed to be done.
And did that trigger also to move into something else, or what was that just a matter of timing?
No, that was just a matter of timing, honestly. I would say, again, that was a really sort of a watershed moment for me as a professional, because I really started to understand leadership in this very different way. And that it was not necessarily attached to my title or sort of hierarchically in the sort of ecosystem of that organization. I was providing leadership to my clients, my caseload. And that's what was expected of me. So it started to open the lens a little bit for me on really understanding what leadership was, because I had seen it at that time, and again, as a young person, more as something to be accumulated, like things, right? Titles and more power and more responsibility, and of course, more dollars. And this brought, again, like a whole new dimension to what it was to sort of live up to the standard, or you know, what he really at that time explained to me as the mantle of leadership.
Got that. And I don't know if you've done that intentionally or not, but as we're going to talk about branding, it seems that when you talk about leadership as you do right now, it you can almost replace that by talking about brandings. Am I right to think that make that connection, or is that not related?
Yeah, no, I think you absolutely can. In particular, on sort of the personal front, if we were talking about personal branding, I think unequivocally you can make that connection.
Okay.
And, you know, in terms of sort of, I think, you know, maybe as we get a little deeper into this, if we end up talking about fandom and some of these things as well, you know, for me, so much of leadership, as I understand it today, also connects back to this, you know, sense of identity. And I have always been drawn personally to leaders who I believe are very comfortable in their own skin. Okay. And so you can replace that with words like authentic and sincere and, you know, so on and so forth. But I think when you come across somebody in that way, it's very honest. And I think you can immediately identify it as trustworthy. And really, that's what, to me, leadership is all about is, you know, do people trust you to sort of lead them into or through, insert, you know, whatever you want to put there. And so, yeah, can you be the leader as the CEO of an organization? Unequivocally, you can. Can you be, you know, the leader of a Boy Scout troop? unequivocally you can. So again, what it really sort of started to show me was if this was something that I was going to kind of hang my proverbial brand Peter hat on, then I was going to have to really start to understand this as it related to me and how I was going to then sort of play that back to the people around me to see, you know, whether or not they actually viewed me that way.
So does that mean, am I hearing you saying that your personal experience made you think about branding leadership as a concept, which allowed you to think about, hey, how can I use this as a profession?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, without question. And okay. And I think, you know, what I saw was a lot of people who were my age who at that time had not had sort of the opportunity that I had to get sort of taught that lesson, who were still kind of like chasing down what I thought at the time were sort of the wrong things, right? And they were sort of accumulating things with the intent that the totality of the things they were accumulating was going to be sort of the stored equity that they needed to be seen as leaders, versus having, again, this really clear sense of identity and, you know, what I valued at that time and sort of where I placed my time and energy. And there were going to be people who were either drawn to that. And in being drawn to it, we would build trust and connectedness and so on and so forth. Or they just, you know, it wouldn't be appealing to them, in which case it wasn't meant to be a repellent as much as sort of like a self-selector. And I started to recognize that, you know, that was happening around me with businesses and companies, and, you know, also it was sort of the world is almost like a culmination of that happening real time everywhere. So as I learned to kind of orientate myself in that, it allowed me to sort of progress professionally.
So when you then develop yourself as, could I call you a brand consultant? How would you qualify? What's your own brand? Maybe let me rephrase my question. What is your brand now?
Yeah, so I think, you know, consultant is kind of an interesting word. You know, I think, you know, we struggle with it in our business today because people like to put us in the box of being an agency. Yeah. And a lot of that has to do with physiologically, part of our development is to be able to collate. That's how we all stay alive, frankly, right? We're collating what's dangerous, what's not dangerous, who's a mate, who's not a mate, all these sorts of things. So we like to basically put people into boxes. I would say, you know, less a brand consultant and more a behavioralist. And a behavioral strategist. And that is to say, it's a bit broader than that. I have to tell you, I think the word brand is a little overused today, so much so that people don't really actually know how to define it in sort of a lot of just common use. That's not a knock on anybody. I think, you know, it's just a very pervasive term right now. And 9 times out of 10, when you ask somebody what it means, they either don't really have an answer or it's a very different answer than the next person you ask.
Okay, but so I understand what you are doing. You are helping, and that's actually a question. Are you helping people or are you helping organizations, corporations to understand behavior of their environment?
Yeah, so it's both. And I would sort of, I would take the moment to say to us, organizations are made up of people. So when you're helping people, it's a very sort of natural step to then be helping organizations. And, you know, what's interesting about brand, just like when we're talking about an individual who's very kind of comfortable in their own skin, and that makes them attractive to a certain, you know, a certain group of other people, companies and organizations work in the same way, right? So, you know, when you see a brand that it's really clear what it stands for and what it identifies with, it sort of triggers that in people too, either aspirationally, they want to sort of glean what all that meaning is, or they see it in themselves already and they're naturally drawn to it because it's sort of creating this mirroring effect. This is why the trust component is so important, because you can cheat on that in the beginning to draw people. But as soon as they get there and they unearth that this is not real, it's really very damaging either to an individual and their personal brand or to companies because you've broken that sort of sacred trust. And more often than not, you haven't just repulsed them, you've basically sent them to your competitors.
Okay. Now, what I'm now hearing you is talking about a corporation building trust with their client base. I will come to that a little bit later. I can also imagine you have to yourself work on the same trust issue. And I can imagine that when you talk about a brand, when you break down what a company actually stands for, and sometimes you have to hold up the mirror, and then what you claim to be is not where you are, how often do people or organizations have, in your opinion, a different perspective of who they are than who they think they really are? So how often do you have to defend yourself by, hey, look, I'm just reflecting who you are, and it's not what you think you are? How often does that happen?
Almost every time.
Yeah.
And that's not meant as any sort of slight or indictment. You know, I think typically our clients, you know, they're really caught up in the day-to-day transactional nature of their business. And so it's very difficult when you're sort of down in the trenches and you're dealing with, you know, what has to get done in a day, and the business is sort of like growing while that's happening. If you don't sort of make the time to get up to 30,000 feet and ask that very question that you did, it sort of gets away from companies. Okay. And then a lot of times there is, you know, typically some kind of an incident that's occurred, or growth goes into decline, and these kind of questions get asked. And then we get brought in to basically say, we can't answer this question ourselves. We need an objective sort of third party to come in and frankly help us. That's right. Help us kind of peel this back and try to understand where the disconnect is between what we think we are, but why our constituents or our customers or our clients don't share that same opinion.
Okay.
So we kind of coined that as organizational mythology, right? We sort of walk around telling ourselves what we need to hear to feel good about our day to day, but we're just telling ourselves, which blinds us to the fact that other people don't share the same story or narrative.
And then you're brought in and you're going to tell them the good news, guys. This is actually what you're about. Now, how do you secure your own trust of that organization so that they really want to listen to you? Do you have an insight in how you do that? Is that track record? Is that based on your personal, your persona? How does that happen?
Yeah, so I think it's two. That's a really good question. I think first and foremost, the vast majority of new clients that we encounter are on referral. And typically we end up working with CEOs, boards. So we don't really come in through the marketing department in a typical brand sort of environment where, you know, an agency wants to, you know, be hired by the CMO. And that's why the work that we're doing, we really talk about it as enterprise level strategy. And so when you get this kind of work right, and everybody organizationally essentially buys into it, so co-develops the work, then they're much, much more apt to adopt it organizationally. And so I think, you know, when you come in with a referral from somebody else, typically that is the sort of first kind of dose of trust that's needed to get to the table and then start having the conversations. And then honestly, you know, Fritz, we're just very kind of frank about how all of this connects to business imperatives. And I would tell you, it's not for everybody. Mm-hmm. And we're very honest about that upfront with leaders as well. But the leaders who I think we connect with have a sense for this already. And they know that this is messy work because it really is about people. And it has to be sort of patiently unearthed and reconstructed. This is not about kind of like slapping a new campaign together, putting a fresh coat of brand paint on the company and, you know, a new slogan and then pushing out against a new audience. Those things, in my experience, don't sort of stand the test of time.
That sounds, those seem to be like superficial solutions. And what you're addressing is you need to really look at the core or the content and address that, not just the wrapper.
That's right. And content, so sort of a really interesting word that you bring up, because I think a lot of companies feel like content is some kind of silver bullet, right? They're just going to start producing a lot of content. They're going to push that out. That's what's going to connect people to them, you know, essentially bring them into the organization so that they can convert on, you know, whatever their product or service is. The problem with that is content has become so prolific, right? That it's for individuals very difficult to sort of sort through all the content that's out there. A lot of them are not particularly well done. And I don't mean from a production value perspective. A lot of the content just doesn't connect back to anything meaningful. And so, you know, typically when you're talking about brands and you know, you and I have talked previously about communities, if it's not clear what the shared meaning at the center of that community is, then it's very difficult to keep people attached to it. They may be curious and sort of come past it and then just sort of move on because they just don't feel like there's any connective tissue for them to identify with. So when, you know, we have a client who we're actually working with right now, and they're absolutely fantastic. And, you know, their CEO is really hell-bent on, we're going to go out and we're going to build a community. And, you know, we had a very honest conversation. Like, I think that's a really poor idea. And he said, well, I think we already have a community. And I said, no, you have a group of customers. And that's great. And we don't want to take anything away from that. But a group of customers who uses your product on a reoccurring basis does not amount to a community. So, you know, I think in today's world, we're sort of in love with this idea of we're going to go out and create communities. But communities are really difficult to form and even more difficult to sort of keep intact because...
Because you also mentioned something else, and I don't know if that because you have a sports background, sports marketing, that where you have to deal with a lot of fans. But I also see you talking about the need to create fandom for all those other corporations out there. So can you take us a little bit long? How can you create fandom? Because I think that's a little bit what you're talking about right now.
It is. And sports is a fantastic metaphor for fandom because it's so overt, right? And especially in Western culture, and not to suggest that it doesn't exist in other cultures, but it's incredibly pervasive. And I think, you know, when we broke fandom down and researched this to really understand what is the psychosocial structure of fandom, it really meets three core needs in individuals. The things that we are fans of, okay, and let's just stay with the sports metaphor. So I'm going to assume you're a football fan, and you have your, you know, member team that you cheer for, and you probably have had them for a long time. And if I was guessing, it might even be connected all the way back to your dad or your family who socialized you on that club, right? So there's a long lineage of how that came to be. So what we know is the things that we are fans of are reflective of our sense of identity. And then secondly, the things that we are fans of meets our needs around group affiliation. So when you go to a match, your favorite soccer team, and you take your jersey and you've got your scarf maybe, and you know the chants and all those kind of things, you know what door to go through and you know what to order and all those kinds of things, you are part of something much larger, because as you look around, everybody else is either wearing the scarf you're wearing or they're admiring yours because it was your dad's from 40 years ago. And they're thinking, oh my gosh, he's been a fan for, you know, all these generations. And so you have this sort of like, you are revered amongst this group. Well, that is all code to say that that group affiliation is honestly where we find a lot of personal safety in the world, right? And then the last thing that fandom really creates is our need for self-care. So a lot of times, look, I play golf. I like to play golf and I watch golf, but I really like to play golf. And sometimes I will say things like, you know, I really deserve to go play golf this weekend. It's been a really hard week. I've been working really hard, which is code for I'm going to have 5 hours outside. it's going to be relatively quiet. I'm going to be doing this thing that I really enjoy doing. And I really only do it with people I like. I'm a bit of a snob that way, in terms of when I do get those 5 hours, I don't want to play with somebody I don't like.
It makes sense to me, at least. Yeah, it's your time.
There's a lot of self-care that's wrapped up in that, right? So while we're talking about sports, there are lots of other brands that people are fans of.
Can you give examples how you translate those sport metaphors to a normal brand, non-sport brand?
Well, look, we actually work in aviation. Okay.
Yeah.
And so when you think about, you're a person who travels a lot. I travel a tremendous amount as well. I only travel on one airline. If I have to choose another airline, I will, but I'm not price sensitive when it comes to my air travel, because I really, really am a fan of the carrier that I use very often. And because of that, I'm a diamond category flyer because I fly a lot. So when I walk on an airplane, typically I get, welcome aboard, Mr. Sarkoff, right? Because they know I'm this category. I fly a lot. They know my preferences, all these kinds of things. I know where their clubs are and the airports that I frequent. I like them. They have the things I like. It's again, the same structure in terms of how my needs are met. And by the way, right, when I say who that airline is, most other people say like, oh yeah, no, they're really great, aren't they? And then they say, are you a diamond? And I'm like, I'm a diamond.
Yeah.
So again, in that structure, a lot of the same metaphors that you see in sports, if we were talking about your scarf and knowing what door to go into and being able to identify with everybody else is in that stadium, in a microcosm, that happens in those other environments as well. And we could go through and talk about, you know, somebody who's, let's say, a fan of Gucci or maybe Rolex or Porsche, or, you know, there's all kinds of other brands like that.
Well, you've actually just mentioned, that was actually a question I had. You mentioned a number of luxury brands, Porsche, Gucci. Brings me to the question, can any product in your view out there create a fandom, or is a particular prerequisite for your organization, product or service in order for it to create fans?
Yeah, I don't think that every company out there sort of has that ability. But I think every company can understand these principles and how these needs are met, and that they are largely applicable. Because even if you felt like, well, I have the kind of company that it would be difficult externally to be able to sort of, you know, build that kind of fandom, as a leader, you can certainly use those principles to build a sense of fandom inside of your organization. As it relates to longevity and lifespan with employees and reducing churn. And, you know, so it's like, you know, fandom is very irrational. Okay. It's very, very emotive. So it's not particularly rational and thought out. So you're walking around in, let's say, a $200 jersey with another man's name on the back. There's nothing rational about that. Okay. It's explainable, but it's not rational. I think, you know, when you're internally inside of a company, you want the same sort of cascading benefits that come from fandom, which is people feel devoted and loyal, and they're willing to socialize with others why they feel that sense of loyalty, why they feel taken care of and protected inside of that company. And when new people come into the company, they will go and socialize those new people, not because they've been asked to, but because they feel a sense of community inside of that organization. Right. So this is why, for me, leadership and this work really kind of work hand in hand, because these are principles that, you know, really, again, become, at the end of the day, they really come back to just human behavior and what we all need, both in our private lives, in our working lives, which today there's not a lot of separation between those things. Right.
It's becoming, I'd say, hybrid. It's very much connected. Peter, I'm loving this conversation. At the same time, I'm conscious of the time at the moment. There's just a couple of questions I want to ask you, because I think we could talk about brands for ages, or branding as an idea. this is the question I have to ask you. How do you want the world to remember you? What's the brand you want to leave behind?
You know, I'm really, from a legacy perspective, only concerned with three people, my three daughters. I think that early lesson that I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation really sort of showed me that I just don't believe, for me, I need to sort of be remembered by anyone in particular other than those three girls. And so it's not that I don't care about, you know, my reputation and how people consider and think of me. I'd like to be thought of as somebody who really was helping other people get to places they want to get to. But at the end of the day, it really comes down to, what have I been able to pour into those three girls and help sort of shape their view of the world so that they can go out and feel like, you know, they're productive and feel successful by their own metrics, as opposed to sort of the metrics that the rest of the world likes to apply to what success looks like.
That's an answer to a question I haven't asked yet, but so thank you for sharing that. And it's actually also a nice segue to my last question for you, because I understand the core should be on family, but is there any advice you can give young people, young managers who are starting out their journey? What do you have any, say, conceptual brand advice for them?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, one of the things we haven't sort of maybe gotten too far into, and we may not have time to get too deep into this. I think for young people who are starting out, there's an interesting balance to me between this notion of being patient and being curious. And so I think I would say, you know, let your curiosity drive you, but also understand it's okay to be patient and to let some things come to you. You don't have to go capture everything right away. And then maybe with that, if we're connecting this back to the brand piece of this, I would really tell maybe my younger self and anybody else who would listen, spend the time to craft your own personal narrative. And think about how that narrative is going to sort of get played out in your professional life, of course. Because if you don't do that, somebody else is either going to do it for you or the world is just going to do it, in which case it's much harder to reclaim your narrative and claw it back from other people when they've sort of typecast you as something than to be confident in what that is. And essentially, you know, be able to lead with that. And then, you know, some people will choose to plug into it and others will choose that it's just not their thing. But that's OK. That sort of goes back to the patient part. So I hope that makes sense and that that's you.
Yeah. It sounds like that's your take on being the master of your own destiny.
100%. Yeah, 100%.
Peter, I want to thank you so much for this great discussion. I hope we've made a number of people very curious to think about their own personal brand. After all, this is the brand called You. So I want to thank you so much for sharing your insights, and we will stay in touch. Thank you so much.
Indeed. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me, Fritz.
Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for the brand called You.